Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really pivotal area for anyone interested in investment law, and that's the governance of mutual funds. Specifically, for you law students listening, we're digging into how courts figure out if investment advisors are, you know, overcharging mutual fund shareholders.
Exactly. It might sound straightforward, but it really opens up a whole can of worms involving fiduciary duties, market forces, and, well, a crucial Supreme Court case that kind of set the modern standard.
And that's the case we're focusing on, Jones v. Harris Associates LP,
right,
from 2010. It was a unanimous decision, which really tells you something about how important the issues were. It's definitely a cornerstone case for shareholder protection regarding advisory fees.
Yeah, before Jones, the main test was the Gartenberg standard from the Second Circuit. But the Seventh Circuit in the Jones appeal, they tried to introduce a totally different, more market-driven approach. So the Supreme Court really had to step in and clarify things.
Okay, let's unpack this, because we're not just talking legal theory here. There are billions of dollars in advisory fees at stake, right? It's a huge chunk of the financial industry.
Mm-hmm.
And it raises that fundamental question. How much oversight is actually needed to keep things fair for regular investors?
Precisely. And for you future lawyers, getting a handle on Jones v. Harris isn't just about, you know, passing an exam on the Investment Company Act. It's about understanding the real-world application of fiduciary duty in a massive economic sector. It's about knowing the legal tools you might use or face to protect shareholders. So, yeah, this deep dive should give you a solid grasp of this landmark case and what it means going forward.
So let's get into the nitty-gritty. What were the specific facts that led to this lawsuit going all the way up?
Okay, so it started with shareholders in several Oakmark funds, the Oakmark Fund itself, the Equity and Income Fund, and the Global Fund. They sued Harris Associates, who was their investment advisor. Now, Harris's fees were based on a percentage of the fund's assets. Simple enough, right? But it meant as the funds grew bigger,
Harris's paycheck grew bigger, too, automatically.
Exactly. And the shareholders weren't just saying the fees were generally high. Their specific claim under Section 36B of the Investment Company Act, that's the key statute here, was that Harris was charging these Oakmark mutual funds way more than they charge other clients, like pension funds, for what the shareholders argued were basically the same services.
Ah, so same work, different price tag, depending on who the client was. That definitely raises an eyebrow.
It does. And a really crucial part of their argument was about economies of scale. You know, as the Oakmark funds got massive, the actual cost for Harris to manage each dollar probably didn't increase proportionally, maybe even decreased.
Right. It gets more efficient to manage larger pools of money.
Correct. And the shareholders argued Harris was just pocketing those savings instead of passing them along to the mutual fund investors, maybe through lower fee rates. That was a big bone of contention.
Okay, so the investors felt they weren't getting their fair share of the benefits from the fund's growth. Got it. How did the lower courts handle this before the Supremes got involved?
Well, it went through the usual steps, but with a really important split in legal reasoning. The district court, the first one to hear it, actually sided with Harris Associates. They used that Gartenberg test we mentioned, at the established checklist, basically, and said, yeah, under these factors, the fees look like they're within a reasonable, you know, arm's length range.
So first round, the court applies the existing rules, says the fees pass muster. But the appeals court saw it differently.
Well, yes and no. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals actually affirmed the district court's decision, so Harris still won that round. But, and this is the critical part, they did it while explicitly rejecting the Gartenberg standard itself.
Whoa, okay, so they agreed with the outcome, but throughout the rule book, what was their reasoning?
Their argument was basically that the market itself was enough protection. They focused heavily on competition between advisors and the fact that fees have to be disclosed. Their view was, look, if investors don't like the fees, they can just move their money elsewhere. So unless there was outright fraud or something deceitful, courts shouldn't be meddling in fee agreements.
Hmm. Relying purely on market forces and disclosure, that's a pretty significant departure.
A huge departure. They essentially said competition and transparency make judicial review under Gartenberg unnecessary, or at least less necessary.
Which sounds plausible on the surface, I guess.
Hmm.
But, obviously, the Supreme Court didn't buy it.
Not at all. The Supreme Court unanimously, remember, everyone agreed, vacated the Seventh Circuit's decision. They basically said, nope, hold on, that Gartenberg test, that's the standard. They put it right back in place as the governing framework for these Section 36B excessive fee claims.
So let's clarify the key legal questions the Supreme Court had to answer them.
There were basically two big ones. First, What level of proof do plaintiffs, the shareholders, need to meet to show an advisor breached their fiduciary duty with excessive fees under Section 36B? And second, is that Gartenberg standard the right way for courts to figure that out?
And the court gave pretty definitive answers, didn't they?
Absolutely. On the first question, they confirmed it's a high bar for plaintiffs. You have to show the fee is so disproportionately large that it couldn't possibly be the result of arm's length bargaining. It's not enough just to say, hey, this fee seems high compared to others. It has to be way out of bounds relative to the services provided.
So a tough standard for shareholders to meet. And on the second question?
Unequivocal yes. The Gartenberg standard is the correct framework. They basically endorse the multi-factor approach that the Second Circuit had laid out decades earlier.
Okay, so Gartenberg is king. Let's really break down those factors for our listeners. What exactly do courts look at under this test?
Right. It's a multi-factor analysis, not just one thing. The first factor is the nature and quality of the services the advisor provides. So what are they actually doing? Portfolio management, sure, but also administrative stuff, shareholder communications, compliance. The whole package.
Makes sense. Better service might justify a higher fee, in theory. What's next?
Second is the profitability of the investment advisor from managing that specific fund. Courts look at the advisor's costs versus the revenue they get from the fees. Are they making a reasonable profit, or is it excessive compared to the work and risk involved?
That sounds like it could get complicated digging into the advisor's books.
It definitely can be. Discovery can be a battle. The third factor is fallout benefits. This means any indirect perks the advisor gets, like boosting their reputation, attracting other business because they manage this prestigious fund, stuff like that. It's considered part of the total compensation package.
Interesting. So it's not just the direct fee payment.
Okay, exactly. Then fourth, and this was central to the Jones case, economies of scale. We touched on this. Does the advisor share the cost savings they get as the fund grows bigger, or are they just letting their profit margin expand? Courts look to see if fee structures have breakpoints where the percentage fee drops as assets increase.
Right. That was the shareholder's core argument about Harris not sharing the benefits. What else is in the Gartenberg mix?
Fifth is comparative fee structures. How do the fees compare to what the same advisor charges other clients, like those pension funds? Or how do they compare to what other advisors charge for similar funds? But importantly, the Supreme Court said comparisons are relevant, sure, but they aren't automatically decisive. There might be good reasons for differences.
Okay, so comparisons matter, but context is key, not just a simple numbers game.
Precisely. And finally, the sixth factor, which is arguably one of the most important in practice. The independence and conscientiousness of the mutual fund's board of directors. The court gives significant weight deference, really, to the board's decision if they were properly informed, truly independent of the advisor, and carefully considered the fee arrangement. The board is supposed to be the shareholders' watchdog here.
So if the board signs off after doing its homework, the fee is likely okay.
That's the presumption, generally. But courts will still look closely at the process. Did the advisor give the board all the necessary information? Was anything misrepresented? Were the independent directors really independent or too cozy with the advisor? If the process was flawed, that board approval loses its protective shield, so to speak.
Gotcha. It's a check on the board, too, not just the advisor. Okay, that's a thorough list. And the Seventh Circuit wanted to ditch all that for just market forces. Why did the Supreme Court say no to that simpler approach?
Their reasoning really gets to the heart of how mutual funds are structured. The court recognized that the mutual fund market isn't like, say, the market for buying groceries. There's an inherent conflict of interest. The investment advisor, the one setting the fees, often has a lot of influence, maybe even control, over who gets picked to be on the fund's board of directors, the very people who are supposed to negotiate those fees.
So the independent board might not be truly independent in practice. The advisor might essentially be negotiating with themselves, or at least with friendly parties.
That's the potential problem the court identified. Because of that structural conflict, just relying on fee disclosure and assuming investors can easily switch funds might not be enough protection. The advisor has an informational advantage, and the board might not be a strong enough counterweight. That's why the judicial oversight provided by Section 36B and the Gartenberg test remains necessary, in the court's view.
That makes a lot of sense. It acknowledges the unique setup of the industry. And didn't Justice Thomas write separately a concurring opinion?
He did. Justice Thomas agreed with the outcome Gartenberg is the standard, and deference to informed boards is appropriate. But he added a cautionary note. He worried that applying Gartenberg might tempt courts to start acting like rate setters, deciding what a fair fee is in the abstract. He emphasized the standard should really focus on whether the fee is so disproportionate that it couldn't have been the result of arm's-length bargaining, rather than a judge just substituting their own idea of fairness.
An interesting nuance. Keep the focus tight on the arm's-length bargaining concept. Okay, so pulling this all together for the law students listening, what are the absolute must-know takeaways from Jones v. Harris?
Okay, number one, investment advisors have a fiduciary duty under 36B, period. They can't charge excessive fees. But number two, the burden is on the plaintiffs, the shareholders, to prove excessiveness. And it's a high bar, so disproportionately large compared to services and not within the range of what could have been negotiated at arm's length. Just showing a fee is high isn't enough.
And the role of the board.
Absolutely critical. Takeaway number three. The independence, diligence, and the process followed by the mutual funds board in approving the fees are hugely important. Courts will give significant deference to a board that does its job properly. A flawed process, though, undermines the fee's legitimacy.
What about those fee comparisons? Pension funds versus mutual funds, for example.
Relevant? Yes, that's takeaway four. Comparisons are definitely part of the evidence under Gartenberg, but they aren't the be-all and end-all. The court made it clear you have to look at the whole picture, all the factors together. Context matters.
And big picture, this case reinforces the whole point of the Investment Company Act, right?
Exactly. Takeaway five. Jones v. Harris reaffirms that the ICA exists specifically to deal with the built-in conflicts of interest in the mutual fund world and to protect investors who might otherwise be vulnerable in that structure.
This has been super helpful, really clarifying the landscape. One last thought. Looking ahead, you mentioned technology. With sophisticated data analysis, AI, all that, could how courts apply these Gartenberg factors change? Could technology make fee analysis, I don't know, more objective or change the game?
That is a great question and very timely. It's certainly possible. Think about the comparative fee structures factor. AI could potentially analyze massive data sets of fees, performance, fund characteristics, advisor specifics, maybe even board connections, far more comprehensively than humans can. It might identify benchmarks or anomalies that aren't obvious now.
So potentially a more data-driven approach to comparisons.
Potentially. It might also help quantify economies of scale more effectively. But then again, factors like the nature and quality of services or the conscientiousness of the board, those seem inherently more qualitative, harder for an algorithm to assess. There's still likely going to be a significant role for human judgment, legal argument, and frankly, understanding the nuances of the board's deliberations. So AI might become a powerful tool within the Gartenberg framework, but maybe not replace the framework itself. It's definitely something to watch.
Fascinating stuff. A really good point to end on. Okay, so just to quickly recap our deep dive. Jones v. Harris solidified the Gartenberg standard for mutual fund fee challenges. It stresses looking at all the factors, gives major weight to truly independent and careful board approval, and confirmed that just relying on market forces isn't enough given the industry structure.
Right. It's the key case for understanding advisor fiduciary duties on fees under the Investment Company Act and the protections shareholders have. A must-know for anyone heading into this area of law.
Absolutely. And for all you future legal minds listening, think about this. As technology evolves and the financial markets change, how will you apply the principles from Jones v. Harris? What ethical lines do you draw when representing shareholders challenging fees or advisors defending them? Lots to consider. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.